By reading a poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Sleep, comrades, sleep and rest on this field of the grounded arms, where foes no more molest, nor sentries shot alarms. We have slept on the ground before and started to your feet at the cannon's sudden roar and the drums redoubling beat. But in this camp of death, no sound your slumber breaks. Here is no fevered breath, no wound that bleeds and aches. All is repose and peace. Untrampled lies the sod. The shots of battle cease. It is the truce of God. Rest, comrades, rest and sleep. The thoughts of men shall be as sentinels to keep your rest from danger free. Your silent tents of green we deck with fragrant flowers. Yours has the suffering been, the memory shall be ours. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote this poem, Decoration Day, in 1882. In honor of Decoration Day, which was first observed in 1868. On May 5th, 1868, General John A. Logan, Commander-in-Chief of the Grand Army of the Republic, an organization of Northern Civil War veterans, issued a proclamation asking that Decoration Day be observed annually throughout the United States. At least in part, the proclamation reads, "The 30th of May, 1868, is designated for the purpose of strewing with flowers or otherwise decorating the graves of comrades who died in defense of their country during the late rebellion, and whose bodies now lie in almost every city, village, and hamlet, churchyard in the land." The date of May 30th was chosen because it was not the anniversary of any Civil War battle. On that first Decoration Day, General James Garfield gave a speech at Arlington National Cemetery, and 5,000 participants decorated 20,000 Union and Confederate soldier graves that day. While we do not know the exact origin for the decoration of Civil War graves, we do know that the practice goes much further back in history than that. In the United States, it certainly predates the Civil War. We also know for some time before this first Decoration Day in 1868, especially in the South, there were similar observations in many cemeteries and gravesites. By 1890, all of the northern states had made Decoration Day an official state holiday. Most of the southern states continued to honor their dead on different days. Over time, things began to change. Southern states began to adopt May 30th. During World War I, the holiday evolved to honor all American soldiers who died in all wars. The name Memorial Day, introduced in 1882, slowly gained popularity. But it wasn't until after World War II that the name Memorial Day became more common than Decoration Day, and it didn't become an official, or it didn't become the official name of the holiday that we are about ready to celebrate this coming Monday until 1967. In June 1968, just over 100 years after the first observance of Decoration Day, Congress passed the Uniform Monday Holiday Act, which moved Memorial Day and three other holidays from their traditional dates to specified Mondays. Memorial Day was moved from May 30th to the last Monday in May. this act also declared Memorial Day a federal holiday. And this all went into effect in 1971. Other than this being Memorial Day weekend, why bring all of this up? We too have been at war, haven't we? And we have soldiers who have died fighting that war along the way. And I think it is appropriate to remember and honor them on occasion. In some ways, this very book is a book of remembrance to many of the faithful soldiers who died fighting the ultimate war. So today, let's take some time to look at some of the people and their stories who have died in the faith. Please turn to Genesis 48, where we will begin with a brief look at a couple of men who kept the faith to the very end. For the most part, all we really have time for today is to see brief glimpses into the lives of a few of the faithful soldiers. Here in Genesis 48, we begin at the very end of Jacob's life. Beginning in verse 1, Genesis 48, verse 1, it says, "Now it came to pass after these things that Joseph was told, 'Indeed, your father is sick.' And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And Jacob was told, 'Look, your son Joseph is coming to you.' And Israel strengthened himself and sat up on the bed. Then Jacob said to Joseph, 'God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said to me, "Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make you or make of you a multitude of people and give this land to your descendants after you as an everlasting possession. And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine.'" In verse 8 it says, "Then Israel saw Joseph's sons and said, 'Who are they?'" or "Who are these?" And Joseph said to his father, "They are my sons, whom God has given me in this place." And he said, "Please bring them to me, and I will bless them." Verse 14, "Then Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, 'God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked.'" Israel, Jacob, acknowledged those that came before him. He acknowledged his father and his grandfather as the beginning of his walk in faith. He said, "God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Let my name be named upon them, and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." There is a lot more of this story that we could look at, but before we do look at a little bit more, let's turn back a chapter to Genesis 47. There are a couple of verses at the end of the chapter that I'd like to take a quick look at. Not long before Joseph was told that his father was dying, Jacob had asked him to promise him to do something. And that's what we want to read here, beginning in verse 29, Genesis 47, verses 29 and 30. It says, "When the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, 'Now if I have found favor in your sight, please put your hand under my thigh and deal kindly and truly with me. Please do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers.' You shall carry me out of the out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place. And he said, I will do as you have said. That burial place was the cave at the end of a piece of land that Abraham bought to bury his wife Sarah. The purchase of that land is an interesting story that we don't have time to go into today. It is the first mention of burial. It is the first mention of land ownership. It is the only piece of land in Canaan that Abraham actually owned, even though God had promised it all to him and his descendants. The interesting thing is that this very day, or to this very day, both Jews and Arabs, along with most Christians, recognize where that piece of land and that burial place is. I've been there. I think some of you have probably been there as well. I made note earlier that Memorial Day had its origin as Decoration Day. Decoration Day was a day to go and put flowers or otherwise decorate the graves of those who had died for their country in battle. There is something about knowing where our ancestors are buried that helps us to remember them and to know who they were and what they stood for. It isn't just the location where Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were buried that is mentioned in the Bible. I want to read just one verse, if you'd hold your place there in Genesis, because we're going to come right back there. But I want to read one verse from Acts 2 to illustrate this. It comes from the middle of Peter's sermon on Pentecost. Acts 2, verse 29. It says, "Men and brethren," and this is Peter speaking, he says, "Men and brethren, let me speak freely to you of the patriarch David, that he is both dead and buried, and his tomb is with us to this day." They remembered where he was buried. Not only is David mentioned, as I said, but they still knew where he was buried. That tomb was a reminder to them of who David was and how important he was to each one of their lives. I mentioned earlier, the Bible is in part a book of remembrance, and it does remind us of where we came from, those who came before us and prepared the way for us. David is mentioned over 50 times in the New Testament alone. Abraham is mentioned over 70 times in the New Testament. We need to remember those who died in the faith. God does. Their stories are here to help us. Let's go back to the story of Jacob and Joseph again, this time in Genesis chapter 50. It was important to Jacob to be buried in the tomb of his fathers. And it wasn't just Jacob that felt that way, as we'll see as we continue the story here in Genesis 50. Beginning in verses 15. It says, "When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, 'Perhaps Joseph will hate us, and he may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him.' And so they sent him a message and asked forgiveness, and then went to him, offering themselves as his servants." And then down in verse 19, we see a bit of Joseph's character. See, Joseph understood the faith of his fathers. It was passed on down to him. He knew what God had in mind for him. He knew what God expected of him. And as we read through the whole story of Joseph, we would see that from the time that he was a young man when he entered Egypt, he understood what God expected. Here Joseph says, in verse 19, Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about, as it is this day, to save many people alive. Now therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation. The children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were also brought up on Joseph's knees. And Joseph said to his brethren, "I am dying. But God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land of which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." At the very end of his life, he too acknowledged those that came before him, those that passed on their understanding, their faith to him. Then Joseph, verse 25, took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, "God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here." So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. And when they did leave Egypt, the Israelites did take his body with them. And he is also thought to be buried with his forefathers in that cave in Hebron. There are many places we can turn to look at men and women who have died in the faith, who stayed faithful to God their entire lives. But I think one of the best places to go is Hebrews 11. We often go here when we talk about faith. But today I want to focus more on the people than about their actions. And as we read through the chapter, we might take a detour or two and take a look or a bit more closely at some of those faithful soldiers. We're going to begin in verse 4, Hebrews 11, verse 4. It says, "By faith Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and through it he, being dead, still speaks." He still speaks because we remember him. He is one of those mentioned here and in the Bible of being a faithful soldier in our ultimate war. Verse 5, "By faith Enoch was taken away so that he did not see death and was not found because God had taken him. For before he was taken, he had this testimony that he pleased God." We need to remember each and every one of these men who came before us, men and women mentioned in the Bible. Verse 7, "By faith Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith." We know most of these stories very well. But most of the time when we read the Bible, we're looking for lessons that apply to our lives, and sometimes we just overlook the fact that these are our forefathers, that they're there for a reason, not just to see the lessons that we can learn, but also to acknowledge that they've made it. They fought the good fight. It gives us hope that maybe we can as well. Verse 8, "By faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out of the place which he would receive as an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Abraham never lost sight of the true promise that God made to him. Sometimes we overlook Sarah. We remember that she laughed when God promised her a son. But here she is, mentioned here in verse 11, by faith, Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. Verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the promise, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. As we should today. As many did in the past. Verse 17, by faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promise offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called, concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. Verse 20, by faith Isaac, so that faith, that truth was passed on down to his son Isaac. By faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. He understood what God had promised. He trusted in God. He believed it. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped, leaning on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. We read those things already. Verse 23, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents. We tend to focus on Moses, but here his parents are mentioned among the faithful. They trusted God because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's command. Verse 24, by faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. He had his priorities right. He gives us hope. That's what we want. We want to put God and Jesus Christ above everything else in our lives. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Down in verse 31 then, it says, by faith the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. Let's take a brief look at Rahab and her story. We find that in Joshua 2 and also in Joshua 6. We're going to start in Joshua 2, verse 1. This is just before the Israelites entered into the promised land. They were still on the other side of the river. It says in verse 1 here, Joshua 2, verse 1, now Joshua the son of Nun sent out 2 men from Acacia Grove to spy secretly, saying, go view the land, especially Jericho. So they went and came to the house of a harlot named Rahab and lodged there. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country. They had heard what had happened along the way, and they were afraid. So the king of Jericho, verse 3, sent to Rahab, saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the country. Then the woman took the 2 men and hid them So she said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And it happened as the gate was being shut when it was dark that the men went out. Where the men went, I do not know. Pursue them quickly, for you may overtake them." But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them with the stalks of flax, which she had laid out in order on the roof. Then the men pursued them by the road to the Jordan, to the fords. And as soon as those who pursued them had gone out, they shut the gate. Now before they lay down, Rahab, it says, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, "I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you, for the Lord your God." She acknowledged that it was God who had done these things for Israel. She goes on and says, "He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now therefore, I beg you, swear to me by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you also will show kindness to my father's house and give me a true token and spare my father, my mother, my brothers, my sisters, and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death." So the men then promised that they would do that as long as she brought everyone to her home and tied that scarlet rope in the window that she had let them out of to escape and go back to the Israelites. We can then go to chapter 6, where we pick up the story. In the meantime, Joshua was told what he should do as they faced Jericho, and that they were to march around the city. And after doing that for 7 days, then they had some special instructions where they were to not only blow the trumpets, but then all the people were to shout. Verse 20, Joshua 6, verse 20, it says, "So the people shouted when the priests blew the trumpets. And it happened when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, and the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell flat down. Then the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city." Verse 22. "But Joshua had said to the two men who had spied out the country, 'Go into the harlot's house, and from there bring out the woman and all that she has, as you swore to her.'" Verse 25. "And Joshua spared Rahab the harlot, her father's household, and all that she had. So she dwells in Israel to this day, because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho." I think there's a bit more to the story, isn't there? Because she truly did believe in God and knew that God was directing Israel. And she had faith in God. We read in Matthew 1, verse 5, that Rahab was the father of Obed. How about Rahab was the mother of Boaz, the father of Obed, the father of Jesse, the father of David, and on down to be in the line of Jesus. See, it's interesting that God includes in multiple places lists of the ancestors of many of God's people. There are several places that those are listed, and in some of them, like here in Matthew, there are a few women that are mentioned, because not too many women are mentioned in the ancestry other than that. But here we see Rahab and Ruth. who both had a great deal of faith, even though they weren't Israelite. Let's go back to Hebrews 11 once again. This time we'll pick up the narrative in verse 32, Hebrews 11, 32. And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah also, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again. You know, there are a few examples in both the Old and New Testaments of women who had their loved ones raised to life. The story of Elijah and the widow in Zarephath certainly comes to mind. However, I'd like you to turn to 2 Kings chapter 4, where we'll look at another example of a woman who had her dead raised to life again. I wanted to look at this story because it gives us a bit of information about the character of the woman. 2 Kings 4, and we'll begin reading in verse 8. Now it happened one day that Elisha went to Shunem, where there was a notable woman, and she persuaded him to eat some food. So it was, as often as he passed by, he would turn in there to eat some food. Yeah, I wonder why was she a notable woman? Was it because she was the wife of somebody important in the city? Or was she just notable because of her faith? I don't know. Doesn't say. But I'm thinking maybe it's the latter rather than the former. Verse 9, and she said to her husband, "Look now, I know that this is a holy man of God who passes us by us regularly. Please let us make a small upper room on the wall, and let us put a bed for him there, and a table and a chair and a lampstand. So it will be whenever he comes to us, he can turn in there." And it happened one day that he came there and he turned into the upper room and lay down there. And he said to Gehazi, his servant, "Call this Shunammite woman." And when he had called her, she stood before him, and he said to him, "Say now to her, 'Look, you have been concerned for us with all this care. What can I do for you? Do you want me to speak on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army?'" He appreciated what she had done, acknowledged her service to him. She answered, "I dwell among my own people." He says, there's nothing I really need. I'm okay. So he said, "What then is to be done for her?" And Gehazi answered, "Actually, she has no son and her husband is old." And so he said, "Call her." And when he had called her, she stood in the doorway. And then he said, "About this time next year, you shall embrace a son." A miracle. It happened just as he said. And the son grew, became a young boy, and it says in verse 18, and the child grew. Now it happened one day that he went out to his father, to the reapers, and he said to his father, "My head, my head." So he said to a servant, "Carry him to his mother." And when he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her knees till noon and then died. this miracle child that she had never asked for, although I'm sure she desired to have a child, this miracle child that this man of God had promised to her dies. And she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, shut the door upon him, and went out. She then went to where Elisha was and told him what happened. I want you to notice what she says in verse 30. It says, "And the mother of the child said, 'As the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you.' He arose and followed her." She knew what God could do. She had already experienced one miracle in her life, and she was looking for another. And she knew that God could provide that miracle to her. And that's what she was asking for. So, verse 32, "When Elisha came into the house, there was the child laying dead on his bed. And he went in, therefore, shut the door behind the two of them, and prayed to the Lord. And he went up and lay on the child, and put his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, and his hands on his hands. And he stretched himself out on the child, and the flesh of the child became warm. He returned and walked back and forth in the house, and again went up and stretched himself out on him. Then the child sneezed 7 times, and the child opened his eyes. And he called Gehazi and said, 'Call this Shunammite woman.' So he called her, and when she came in to him, he said, 'Pick up your son.' So she went in, fell at his feet, and bowed to the ground. Then she picked up her son and went out." God acknowledged her faith, gave her that second miracle of her child being brought back to life. Let's go back to Hebrews 11 once again. And we don't even know what her name was, do we? The Shunammite woman. But somebody who was so important that she's mentioned here in Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11:35 again, "Women received their dead raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, who were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains, in dens and caves of the earth. And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us." As I mentioned before, there are many, many more examples we could look at. But there are just two more in the New Testament that I'd like to take a brief look at. It's not Jesus Christ, not any of the disciples, not Paul or Barnabas or Timothy. Just two ladies that we don't often look at. Turn to Luke chapter 1. Luke tells us the background of Jesus Christ. And here he talks about two ladies that we should acknowledge who were faithful. Begin reading here in verse 5. Luke 1, verse 5. "There was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zacharias, of the division of Abijah. His wife was of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth." It says in verse 6, "They were both righteous before God, walking in all the commandments and ordinance of the Lord blameless. But they had no child because Elizabeth was barren, and they were both well advanced in years." You know the story. While while Zacharias was serving in the temple, he saw an angel who told him that he was going to have a child with Elizabeth. He wasn't quite sure what all that was about, didn't believe completely at the beginning, and so God told him what? That he couldn't speak until the child was born. Somehow he must have communicated all of that to Elizabeth. She became pregnant just as the angel had told them. It says down in verse 14, it says, this is part of the message that was given to him. It says, "And you will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth. For he will be great in the sight of the Lord, and shall drink neither wine nor strong drink. He will also be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from his mother's womb, and he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God." In verse 26, it goes on and it says, "Now in the sixth month," so this is the sixth month of Elizabeth's pregnancy, "the angel Gabriel was sent by God to a city of Galilee named Nazareth, to a virgin betrothed to a man whose name was Joseph, of the house of David. The virgin's name was Mary. And having come in, the angel said to her, 'Rejoice, highly favored one. The Lord is with you. Blessed are you among women.'" Now, I know we acknowledge and we understand Mary and her role, but we don't often talk about her. I think it's probably the stigma of how other religions view her. But we should. We need to understand her role and why she was chosen. She wasn't just some random woman in Israel. She was chosen specifically. She was a highly favored woman by God. Verse 29, "But when she saw him, she was troubled at his saying, and considered what manner of greeting this was. Then the angel said to her, 'Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. And behold, you will conceive in your womb and bring forth a son, and shall call his name Jesus.'" What an incredible blessing she was given. She must have been some special woman. I'm going to drop down further into the story because I want to look at a little bit of what those two women were like. Down in verse 39, it talks about Mary going to visit her cousin. It says, "Now Mary arose in those days and went into the hill country with haste to the city of Judah, and entered the house of Zacharias and greeted Elizabeth. And it happened, when Elizabeth heard the greeting of Mary, that the babe leapt in her womb. And Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit. Then she spoke out with a loud voice and said, 'Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb. But why is this granted to me, that the mother of my Lord should come to me? For indeed, as soon as the voice of your greeting sounded in my ears, the babe leapt in my womb for joy.'" She understood what was taking place here, didn't she? "Blessed is she who believed, for there will be a fulfillment of those things which were told her from the Lord. And Mary said, 'My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit has rejoiced in God my Savior. For he has regarded the lowly state of his maidservant. For behold, henceforth all generations will call me blessed. For he who is mighty has done great things for me, and holy is his name. His mercy is on those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts. He has put down the mighty from their thrones and exalted the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things, and the rich he has sent away empty. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, as he spoke to our fathers, to Abraham, and to his seed forever. So again, she even acknowledged those that came before her. She remembered where that truth had come from and those who had faith before her. We have looked at a number of people who have died in the faith. God thought their stories were important enough that he included them in his word. And we should acknowledge them, not just for the lessons that we can learn from their lives, but them for what they did in their lives, for being faithful to the end. But what about more recently? Remember what it says at the end of Hebrews 11, in verses 39 and 40. It says, "And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us." They will receive the promise. And so will we if we endure to the end. Some of our loved ones have also died, having obtained a good testimony through faith. They have not yet received the promise, but they will. How often do we remember them in that way? I have a list of people that I need to remember. You probably do too. They came before me. They helped me along the way. I wouldn't be the person that I am without them. They died in the faith, having endured to the end. Maybe a mother or a brother for some of you, an aunt or an uncle, a husband or a wife. Friends. Joe and Elsie Young are on my list. The Dennises, Mrs. Berg, and certainly my father-in-law. I think Dwayne had an impact on many of you here as well. There are probably others that you know, the Millers, maybe the Tomiches, Claiborne Sr. So with them in mind, I want to read one more story. It is a much more contemporary story than those that we have read so far, although still ancient history for some of you. And it comes from the Autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong, Volume 1. I want to read some excerpts from pages 261 to 264. He writes, "We had been visiting my parents in Salem. My wife had become acquainted with an elderly neighbor lady, a Mrs. Ora Runcorn. Mrs. Runcorn was an avid student of the Bible. Before our marriage, my wife had been quite interested in Bible study. She had been for years an active Methodist. After marriage, although she had not lost her interest in the Christian life and the Bible, she had not had the same opportunity to express it or participate in religious fellowship with others. But all Mrs. Armstrong's active interest in things biblical was reawakened when she became acquainted with Mrs. Runcorn. One day, Mrs. Runcorn gave her a Bible study. She asked my wife in turn, or asked my wife to turn to a certain passage and read it. Then a second, then a third, and so on for about an hour. Mrs. Runcorn made no comment, gave no explanation or argument, just asked my wife to read aloud a series of biblical passages. "Why," exclaimed Mrs. Armstrong in amazement, "do all these scriptures say that I've been keeping the wrong day as the Sabbath all my life?" "Well, do they?" asked Mrs. Runcorn. "Don't ask me whether you have been wrong. You shouldn't believe what any person tells you, but only what God tells you through the Bible." "What does He tell you there? What do you see there with your own eyes?" "Why, it's as plain as anything could be," exclaimed Mrs. Armstrong. "Why, this is a wonderful discovery. I must rush back to tell my husband the good news. I know he'll be overjoyed." A minute or so later, Mrs. Armstrong came running into my parents' home with the good news. My jaw dropped. This was the worst news I had ever heard. My wife going into religious fanaticism. "Have you gone crazy?" I asked incredulously. "Of course not. I was never more sure of anything in my life," responded my wife with enthusiasm. Indeed, I wondered if she really had lost her mind, deciding to keep Saturday for Sunday. Why, that seemed like rank fanaticism, and my wife had always had such a sound mind. There was nothing shallow about her. She had always had a well-balanced mind with depth. But now, suddenly, this. It seemed incredible, preposterous. "Loma," I said sternly, "this is simply too ridiculous to believe. I am certainly not going to tolerate any such religious fanaticism in our family. You'll have to give that up right here and now." But she wouldn't. "Doesn't the Bible say that wives must be obedient to their husbands?" I asked. "Yes, in the Lord, but not contrary to the Lord," she came back. It was amazing how many logical arguments came to my mind, but always she had the answer. In desperation, I said, "Loma, you can't tell me that all these churches have been wrong all these hundreds of years. Why aren't these all Christ's churches?" Then came back Mrs. Armstrong. "Why do they all disagree on so many doctrines? Why does each one teach differently than the others?" "But," I still contended, "isn't the Bible the very source of the teaching of all these Christian churches? And they do all agree on observing Sunday. I'm sure the Bible says, 'Thou shalt keep Sunday.'" "Well, does it?" smiled my wife, handing me a Bible. "Show it to me. If it does, and I'll do what it says. If you can prove by the Bible that Christians are commanded to observe Sunday, then of course I'll do what I see in the Bible." That was her challenge. Why read that particular story? See, for us, this is the beginning of our spiritual journey. It was that brief encounter between Loma Armstrong and Mrs. Runcorn that leads directly to all of us sitting here today. It was this challenge by Mrs. Armstrong to her husband that led to his conversion, ordination, and eventually starting what became the Worldwide Church of God. I don't know whatever became of Mrs. Runcorn, but I'm convinced Mrs. Armstrong died in the faith. We should certainly not worship those who came before us. God certainly shows us in the Bible they're good and bad, doesn't he? And we all have good and bad. But we should at least acknowledge those who died in the faith, at least from time to time. Now, you may think all of this has been interesting, but you might still wonder, is it important? I'd like you to turn to one last scripture, Psalm 116, verse 15. You know, along the way, I kept thinking as I was writing this about a song that we used to sing. I would have asked Clay to play it, but it's not in the books that we have today, and I didn't have time to dig out enough of the old ones. But kept going through my head was Faith of Our Fathers. I think it is appropriate to remember the faith of our fathers from time to time. I think it gives us hope. I think God thinks it's important as well. Psalm 116, verse 15. Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. Why? See, why is it that the death of the saints are important? It is because for those who died in the faith, they've made it. They have endured to the end. They will be there where we all want to be. It is the death of the saints that is precious to God, and if it is precious and important to him, then it should be to us as well. One of the traditions of Memorial Day, and I'll end with this, is that at 3 p.m. local time, a moment of reflection on those who have died in service to our country should be observed. Maybe we should do the same for those who have died in the faith, to take a moment and reflect on those who came before us. Those that are mentioned in the Bible, those that we have known personally. I want to give you the title to my sermon. I titled it Memorial Day, Remembering Those Who Have Died in the Faith. I think it's a good thing to do.